And now we bring you Michael Parente for Radio Truth with What Progressives Want.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parente. Michael Parente is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, will be released in November 2005. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparente.org.
What do progressives want? There are people in the United States who call themselves conservatives, and they get a lot of attention. There are others of us who call ourselves progressives, and we deserve a lot more attention. Senator John Edwards, Democrat in North Carolina when he was still in the Senate, spoke about the two Americas that we have today. One America that does the work, another America that reaps the reward. One America that pays the taxes, another America that gets the tax breaks. One America that will do anything to leave its children a better life. Another America that never has to do a thing because its children are already set for life. One America that's struggling to get by. Another America that can buy anything it wants, even Congress and a president. Well, we progressives, we want to see the emergence and the triumph of that first America. We progressives want to tax the rich, not low-income working people. We want to develop renewable, non-polluting wind, tidal, and solar energy sources, and swift, safe mass transit systems with less reliance on toxic fossil fuels. In contrast to the profit-oriented conservatives who repeatedly profess their love for America but seem unconcerned about America's forests, rivers, wildlife, wetlands, water supplies, and overall ecological health, we progressives put environmental concerns before everything else. Because without a livable ecology, nothing else will survive. We progressives advocate a freedom of speech and freedom of ideas in the major media that would include dissident left views as well as the hardline right-wing and reactionary and conventional centrist opinions that we now are constantly exposed to. We progressives want some relief from the evasive, mealy-mouthed, know-it-all empire-boosting pundits. We want national media debates on the basic assumptions behind U.S. foreign policy. We want to reclaim the nation's airwaves, which belong not to the network bosses, but to the people of the United States. Some of us want a government that will go directly into not-for-profit production. We want a fair chance given to worker-controlled enterprises and to public ownership. If private industry can't provide for the needs of the people, if private industry can't build homes and hospitals enough for all, then the public sector should do so, not by contracting it out to private profiteers, but by direct production, as during the New Deal, when public workers made tents, cots, and shoes, and canned foods for the destitute. A not-for-profit production that created jobs, served human needs, expanded individual spending, and expanded the tax base. All of that done without the parasitic private corporate investors making a penny on it. We progressives want to open up our political system to new political parties, not just two capitalist, globalistic, empire-building parties, not just one party that red baits and liberal baits, and the other party that lives in fear of being red baited and liberal baited. We need to do what revolutionary Nicaragua did and institute proportional representation, ready ballot access to dissident parties, convenient voter registration conditions, more than a workday for voting, a whole weekend in order to vote, public campaign funding, and free TV ads for all political parties. And we above all want honest elections, not elections run by Diebold and private companies that can fix the results any way they want. As Mark Twain put it more than a century ago, his loyalty was not to his country's institutions and office holders as such. His loyalty was to its basic principles of democracy, to the understanding that all political power is inherent in the people and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for the people's benefit, and that they have at all times, the people, at all times, an undeniable and indefeasible right to alter their form of government in such a manner as they may think expedient and workable. In sum, we progressives are interested in the substance of social justice. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can find us on the web at lasoundposse.org.
Here's Joff Parrish with Pacifica Radio, speaking on Medicare Part D.
We're from the government. We're here to make you sick. This is Joff Parrish. Next Monday, May 15th, marks the enrollment deadline for the new Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit. For the tens of millions of elderly, disabled, and low-income Americans who are eligible but who haven't yet enrolled in Part D, it's a critical date. The Bush administration's 2003 bill included, among many other dreadful provisions, a stipulation that after May 15th, anyone without certification of a better drug plan who fails to enroll in Part D will face a 1% per month penalty on their insurance premiums for every month after May 15th that they fail to enroll, for the rest of their lives. After May 15th, enrollment will be closed until the end of the year, so for tens of millions of people who can least afford it, a minimum of 7% lifetime penalty will kick in for the 7 months between now and the end of the year, a so-called senior tax. It'll kick in if they don't enroll by Monday. I'm one of those people, and I'm not enrolling. I'm disabled. I'm a transplant patient. At present, I pay well over $5,000 a year, not including co-pays and other out-of-pocket expenses for my prescription drug coverage. But without coverage, it'd be well over $50,000 a year in any given year if I didn't have any complications. Medicare's Part D would actually save me a couple thousand a year, but I don't dare risk it. Why? Because once I pick one of the 47 or so private insurance plans available through Part D in Washington State, that plan can then change the list of drugs they're willing to cover at any time. And if they decide not to cover one of my expensive, life-giving drugs any longer, I can't do anything about it. I can't change plans for the rest of the year, and I'll simply have to pay for it myself. Meaning that instead of saving a couple of thousand, Part D would wind up costing me as much as $10,000 more. For one drug. I have 20 they can mess with me on. And it's even worse for so-called dual-eligible patients, low-income folks eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. They were all forced off their much better Medicaid drug coverage and randomly assigned a Part D insurance plan, regardless of whether it actually met their needs. And if I can't make sense of all this, me, a relatively well-informed, healthcare-savvy, middle-aged guy, what about my 81-year-old mother? And if mom, who's still pretty healthy and sharp, is befuddled by all this, and she is, how is somebody who's elderly and physically or mentally compromised supposed to cope with all this? Is it any wonder that nearly half of all eligible Americans haven't signed up for Part D yet, guaranteeing, as of next Monday, that minimum 7% lifetime surcharge? The Bush administration and many congressional Republicans couldn't be happier about all this. For them, it's working exactly as designed. The insurance companies will get that lifetime surcharge, not Medicare. The drug and insurance companies that wrote this 2003 bill are laughing all the way to the bank. How lucrative is it? Amazingly, Part D is prohibited by law from doing what every major drug buyer does, negotiating discounts with pharmaceutical companies based on quantity of purchase. Part D, by law, must pay Big Pharma full price, which is, as we all know too well, whatever the heck Pharma wants to charge. Call it welfare. For very rich people. Lots of welfare. For people who are now, thanks to this new program, rapidly becoming very, very rich. There are other major problems with Part D, too. I haven't even touched the infamous donut hole, the gap that requires patients pay nearly $3,000 in out-of-pocket expenses with no coverage before benefits resume. Try that while living on your monthly $880 Social Security disability check. The upshot is that the Medicare drug prescription plan is ghastly expensive for taxpayers, doesn't cover a lot of what it needs to, isn't serving and is therefore penalizing half the population it's supposed to serve, and is terribly confusing for anybody who's trying to navigate it. President Bush, naturally, has pledged to veto any changes to Part D. It's good to know whose side he's on. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Joff Parrish.
You're listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice.
Hello, friends, family, comrades. rebels, insurgents, refugees, exiles, expatriates, people in hiding, and all the ships at sea. I debated whether or not I should say this. I wondered if it would do any good. I have profound fears for the future, deep anger and sadness for my country.
Our country. Our country that's been stolen away from us. Captured by those who traffic in fear and hatred and bigotry and poison.
I feel like we're lost in the forest right now. We're down the rabbit hole.
And there is no end in sight.
I know you all feel the same sentiments.
The rage against the unanswerable abyss, the terror of what lies ahead, the confusion of what this nation has become.
I will not attempt to glide over the monumental disaster that was this election.
There's no silver lining.
There's no redemption. The illusion of hope in this last year
has been mercilessly stripped away.
The monster we face is now unleashed
and free to wreak havoc and spill the blood of innocence.
We are in a dark place.
Perhaps the darkest place.
Unable to even conceive of the idea of light.
But we have been in such midnight moments before.
We have been in the pits of Vietnam.
And the hanging trees of Jim Crow.
We have despaired on the cotton fields of Mississippi.
And the breadlines of the Depression.
We've been beaten down by crooked cops.
Pushed around by factory bosses.
Terrorized by the Klan.
And the fascists.
And the Nazis.
And know-nothing.
And the fat cats.
And robber barons.
And the corrupt politicians
and wicked masters.
But we have never surrendered.
We have never weakened or wavered.
Did we surrender at Kent State?
Jackson State?
No.
Did we surrender at Selma, Alabama?
No.
Did we surrender at Haymarket?
No.
On the lettuce fields of California?
In the textile mills of Massachusetts?
In the coal mines of Colorado?
In the meatpacking plants of Chicago?
At the Stonewall Rides?
At the pro-choice rallies?
At the equal rights for women marches?
At the anti-war demonstrations?
At the strikes and the walkouts?
And the bus boycotts?
No.
No.
No!
Remember, we have history on our side.
We have the march of progress.
The struggle for what is right
and good
and pure
and free
and equal
and just
and beautiful.
We have the raised fist
of every fighter.
We have the righteous yell of anyone who's been wronged by the system
anywhere, at any time.
We have the power of the powerless.
We have the moral clarity of the dispossessed.
We are the heart, the soul of the struggle, the battle that never ends.
Look to our heroes.
We are the inheritors of a proud past
populated by giants,
heroes,
artists,
revolutionaries,
thinkers, believers in mankind,
defenders of the oppressed.
We have the pen of Walt Whitman
and Hemingway,
the determination of Cesar Chavez,
Margaret Sanger and Sojourner Truth,
the faith of Martin and Malcolm,
the beauty of Billie Holiday and Duke Ellington,
the strength of Roosevelt and Kennedy,
the joy of Mark Twain.
The history of America
has been written by us.
It does not belong to demagogues,
the fearmongers,
the war profiteers,
the rich, the greedy,
theocrats,
and the mullahs.
They twist the Constitution,
but we make it straight.
They wrap themselves in the flag,
but we fight for the freedoms,
not the fabric.
They shout out their pledges of allegiance,
but we do the dirty work of democracy.
They claim to represent the real America,
but we are the keepers of the tree of liberty.
It ain't over yet, folks.
Not by a long shot.
They'll cry a few tears.
Bang against the walls.
Scream into the wind.
Then collect yourself
and get back to work.
It's time to punch the clock. The battle for America has begun.
That was The Battle for America, directed by Ulrich Brown, written by Max Skolnick, and produced by Visigoth Pictures. For more information, see thebattleforamerica.com. You're listening to Making Waves. And now for Dave Lippman with Megs and All.
In 1951, I'd just begun. 1951, just begun. Korean War was underway. We had a brand new Chevrolet. We were living the American way in 51. 1955 came civil rights. 1955, civil rights. There was much to overcome. Ku Klux Terror and the gun. Who knew what was to come in 55? 1963 in Washington, we marched to show that freedom could be won. There were freedom songs to sing, and there was Martin Luther King. 1963 in Washington. 1968 we came undone. Revolutions were put down with club and gun. There was blood and there was bombs. Not a nation could be calmed. In 1968, we came undone. In 1969, we walked the moon. On Earth, a man still called his neighbor coon. Some were happy, some did say it was mankind's greatest day. In 1969, we walked the moon. And then the freedom leaders were all gone. Government officials said, be calm. With the killers still at large, Nixon still in charge. So many freedom leaders gone. The 80s were the 50s, upside down. Plutocrats and colonels gaining ground. When we hit 1984, it was like the book, maybe more. Oh, the 80s were dark days all around. Then they invented a new machine, mouse and all. Invented a new machine, megs and all. It's a global clarion call, and gathers data on us all. It's a high-tech shopping mall, mouse and all. One superpower now bestrides the world. Banners of resistance are unfurled. For these people and this earth, a new millennium's in birth. And we will not live in a world of greed. We will not stoop except to plant another seed.
That was Megs and All by Dave Littman. Now for some of our hidden history to reclaim and learn from. Tomorrow is Mother's Day. Mother's Day originally began as an anti-war holiday. In 1872, Julia Ward Howe, author of The Battle Hymn of the Republic, proposed an annual Mother's Day for Peace. For the next 30 years, Americans celebrated Mother's Day for Peace on June 2nd. Many women in the 19th century worked to care for the casualties of society and to turn the U.S. into a more civilized nation. They played a leading role in the abolitionist movement, launched successful campaigns against lynching and consumer fraud, battled for improved working conditions, protection for children, public health services, and social welfare assistance to the poor. And here is the Mother's Day proclamation that Julia Ward Howe wrote in Boston in 1872. Arise, then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts, whether your baptism be that of water or of fears. Say firmly, we will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands shall not come to us reeking with carnage, for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We women of one country will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first, as women, to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them then solemnly take counsel with each other as the means whereby the great human family can live in peace, and each bearing after her own time the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God. That was Julia Ward Howe's 1872 Mother's Day Proclamation for Peace. We hope you share that with your mother tomorrow on Mother's Day. You're listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. Now we bring you Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joshua Rubenstein of Amnesty International USA, who summarizes his group's report to the UN, asserting that the U.S. continues to subject detainees to torture and abuse. Retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who talks about his recent public confrontation with Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and assesses the change in leadership at the CIA. And Ibrahim Ramsey of the Climate Crisis Coalition, who explains the connections he sees between opposition to the Iraq War and the broader struggle to protect the environment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories. France and Chile have embarked on a new initiative to raise funds to provide medicines for HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and other diseases to poor nations by imposing a direct tax on airline tickets that will raise millions of dollars. According to the Interpress service, the tax is the first independent funding scheme implemented to meet the United Nations mandated Millennium Development Goals. The MDGs, as they are known, are targeted to cut extreme poverty and hunger in half, provide universal primary education, reduce the rate of child mortality, and promote environmental sustainability, all by 2015. The new ticket tax is expected to raise $300 million in France and $6 million in Chile. Yet it is only a small down payment on meeting the MDGs, which could require $50 billion a year in new international funding. In addition, Brazil's President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva pledged $12 million in solidarity funds to meet the MDGs and may also institute the tax on airline tickets. Advocates of global justice have long sought a Tobin tax on foreign currency exchange transactions that was first proposed by American economist James Tobin in 1972. Advocates say a small tax on currency transfers could raise $15 billion a year for international programs. Currently, wealthy countries, with a few exceptions like Denmark and Sweden, have failed to meet a 30-year promise to dedicate 0.7% of their economies to aid developing nations. Every night, teams of gunmen roam the streets of the poorest neighborhoods in Guatemala and seize people suspected of wrongdoing. In the morning, corpses are found left behind, usually with signs of torture or strangulation. According to the Washington Post, over 400 people were killed in suspected murders in the first 2 months of 2006 in a violent campaign of social cleansing. In 2005, nearly 3,000 murders took place. The victims were mostly petty thieves or tattooed members of street gangs. So far, the police have arrested few people for these vigilante killings, although in February, police arrested 7 armed men in olive uniforms and black masks who were suspected of committing a dozen murders, as well as shaking down tourists for protection money. Violence seems to be on the rise since the 1996 peace accords that ended the country's 36-year civil war, during which more than 200,000 civilians were killed, mostly at the hands of government-run death squads. Mario Polanco, head of the victim rights organization Mutual Support Group in Guatemala City, observed the armed groups have become so accustomed to killing on their own accord that when they have personal enemies, they'll kill that person too, and the country becomes more and more violent. Y-12, the nuclear bomb-making plant in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, that enriched the uranium for the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, is still in business. But its 6,000 workers have had little to do for 15 years. To keep the factory going, Congress spends $300 million a year to transfer the facility's store of radioactive metal to a new secure site. Y-12 also tests components of existing nuclear weapons to ensure they still work. 1992 was the last year the U.S. government tested a nuclear weapon. According to the Washington Monthly magazine, the National Nuclear Security Administration has a $9 billion annual budget to operate the U.S. nuclear weapons complex, a system of 8 plants that are now obsolete and an open target for terrorists. Last summer, a congressionally mandated report called for the consolidation of the nuclear weapons complex to save billions of dollars and improve security. But the report was rejected by the chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici, who has 2 nuclear labs in his district. In a statement, Domenici declared, "I don't think we need to rush into any quick fixes." In the end, Congress only approved $5 million for fiscal year 2006 to study a plan for the consolidation of the aging nuclear weapons complex. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
A report issued by Amnesty International on May 3rd asserts that torture and other cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment of detainees by U.S. forces is widespread and in many cases sanctioned by high-level government officials. The 32,000-word report was released prior to the beginning of hearings in Geneva on U.S. compliance with the U.N. Convention Against Torture. Amnesty says that evidence continues to emerge that prisoners held by the U.S. are subjected to torture in American-run facilities in Afghanistan, Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba, Iraq, and other locations. The report goes on to say that there is clear evidence that much of the physical and psychological ill-treatment has stemmed directly from officially sanctioned procedures and policies, including interrogation techniques approved by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld for use in Guantanamo and later exported to Iraq. At least 34 detainees who died in U.S. custody have been classified by the Pentagon as suspected homicides. But Amnesty believes that the number may well be higher due to cover-ups. Britain's Attorney General Lord Goldsmith has recently joined Amnesty and other human rights groups in calling for the closure of America's Guantanamo Cuba Detention Center. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director of Amnesty International USA, who summarizes his group's report on U.S. torture.
The U.S. is a signatory to the Convention Against Torture, and all the signatories, there are well over 120, are obliged on a periodic basis to appear before the committee to answer questions. And often this may be a routine thing, or there are some minor matters that have to be raised. I think it's a good component of accountability under the convention. But of course, in recent years, there are serious reports and allegations of mistreatment and torture by U.S. forces in Iraq, and we all know what happened at Abu Ghraib, in Afghanistan, and in Guantanamo. So Amnesty, on the eve of the U.S. appearance before the committee, which actually happened last week, we issued about a 50-page report summarizing all we've learned in the last few years about this really a pattern of torture. We wanted to bring it to the attention of the committee so it would have it on hand when it questioned U.S. officials.
What kind of documentation has Amnesty International done on the continuing conditions in which detainees are being held?
Well, everyone is familiar with the fact that 2 years ago now, the scandal broke at Abu Ghraib, and the administration had to own up to the fact that there were these incidents. But, of course, the administration wants to say that there are always bad apples and that they are holding people accountable. Of course, for the most part, only lower-down officers, not high-ranking officials. But how can you separate the memos that circulated in Washington, in the White House Counsel's Office, in the Department of Justice, in the Pentagon, where they recommended harsh treatment and torture, where they said and they tried to limit the definition of torture so that the interrogation techniques they wanted to use would not be defined as torture as they saw fit? We believe there's a consistent pattern between what Washington was advocating and what soldiers and officers in Guantanamo, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan were actually doing, that you can't dismiss these incidents as an aberration.
Now, what do you hope to accomplish with this report that documents these conditions?
Look, a lot of this news has, of course, been in our national magazines. It's in our newspapers. It's not a secret anymore. Congress has discussed it and tried to explore it, but really in a very limited way because Congress does not wish to hold the White House accountable. The Republicans control both houses of Congress, and frankly, they're not living up to their constitutional obligation to hold the White House accountable. So it's up to human rights organizations like Amnesty International to collect this information, to interview lawyers, to interview detainees when they're released, to get their hands on government documents. And a lot of government documents have been released that have confirmed our worst fears. After all, the ACLU has done a wonderful job under the Freedom of Information Act to get documents out of the government. And this is all confirmed to our satisfaction that this is not an aberrant act of irresponsible or immature individuals, but in fact is a consistent pattern of abuse that reflects government policy. And that's what we want the UN to explore.
Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on the chain of command and where the responsibility lies in terms of these policies that have allowed or encouraged this kind of treatment of prisoners.
Look, we have a document over Mr. Rumsfeld's signature where he calls for various forms of very harsh interrogations, including sleep deprivation, manipulation of the environment, meaning making things hot, making things cold, holding prisoners naked, holding them in stress positions. There's no question that Rumsfeld was trying to have it both ways, trying to say we're not going to use torture, but we're going to use interrogation techniques that obviously will lead officers over the line. Secondly, we know that General Miller in Guantanamo was transferred from Guantanamo to Iraq, and the word is he was told to gitmoize Abu Ghraib, to gitmoize Iraq, to use the techniques that he had employed at Guantanamo and then expand on them in Iraq. And then when General Miller was initially called to testify at a hearing or a trial, he said he would invoke the Fifth Amendment. Now, would he do that if the techniques he had been advocating, he had been insisting on using, crossed the line into torture and mistreatment? Of course not. That's a common sense question. So it seems to us there's more than adequate evidence, not just allegations, but really evidence, that what was going on at Abu Ghraib, that what was uncovered at Abu Ghraib 2 years ago shows a consistent pattern of government policy. And that's what we need to, where we need to hold this government accountable.
Now, it's unlikely that the United Nations has any influence or power to hold our elected officials accountable for the abuse and torture in U.S. facilities. But what is Congress doing? And maybe you can make a comment on the congressional ban that was recently signed into law on torture. However, George W. Bush, as he's done in the Boston Globe, documented these some 700 signing statements, which really provide some kind of loophole, I guess, in the minds of the backers of the unitary executive theory or philosophy that he doesn't really have to comply with congressional law. But tell us a little bit about that.
What you cited is very worrisome. The president has issued these hundreds of signing statements, in particular after he signed the McCain Amendment, which forbade the use of torture and said that all U.S. interrogations have to take place in a way that are consistent with the field manual of our soldiers, which prohibits torture. The president said, sure, I'll sign it, but if I feel it's necessary not to abide by this law, I'll just order people not to abide by it. So he's simply saying that when he chooses to, he's above the law, which is outrageous. And I think shows that the president and his people are not speaking in good faith when they say that they do not support the use of torture, they prohibit the use of torture, they will prosecute people who are caught mistreating prisoners. But they can't say that on the one hand and be taken seriously when the president issues this signing statement, which more or less says, I am above the law.
That was Joshua Rubenstein, Northeast Regional Director with Amnesty International USA. Contact Amnesty by calling area code 212-807-8400 or visit their website at www.amnestyusa.org.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and
said,
we were just.
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and northeast, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
Something unusual happened in Atlanta, Georgia on May 4th. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was confronted with tough questions about the U.S. war in Iraq. The questioner was Ray McGovern, a retired 27-year veteran CIA analyst who had himself been in charge of the president's daily brief during the 1980s. In his now-famous exchange with Rumsfeld, McGovern demanded to know why the defense secretary had lied about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and links to al-Qaeda, the Bush administration's long-disproven rationales for the war. Meanwhile, turmoil at the CIA was evident when Porter Goss abruptly resigned as CIA director and President Bush promptly nominated a successor, General Michael Hayden. Hayden, deputy director of national intelligence and former director of the National Security Agency, quickly came under fire from both Democrats and Republicans for his ties to the Pentagon and his direct involvement in carrying out President Bush's order to perform warrantless surveillance of American citizens. an action many observers maintain violates the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. There is speculation that Goss's resignation could be linked to a bribery scandal involving convicted Republican Congressman Duke Cunningham, defense contractors, poker games, and prostitutes. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Ray McGovern about his encounter with Donald Rumsfeld and his assessment of the changes in leadership at the CIA.
Thank you for asking those tough questions, Ray.
Well, they're questions that need to be asked, and if our domesticated press won't dare to ask them, I guess it falls to us to do so.
Well, you had a powerful presentation. You didn't get to say a lot, but the questions you did ask that were broadcast nationally penetrated the kind of phony credibility that the White House has seemed to have in the press, as you said, for all these years here.
You know, what was unnerving was the reaction of the folks there. I've seen a lot of films of the 30s in Germany, and actually I've lived in Germany for 5 years, and it was scary. You know, these folks began by being told by the president of this center that Rumsfeld was not only really smart, but he was honest. And I said to myself, gosh, you know, that's a little unusual, introducing somebody, say, hey, he's a smart guy, but he's also honest, you know. And then at every turn, for example, when he said, I did not lie, they just, you know, cheered, you know. There was no sense that these folks were open to the possibility that I had an intelligent question to ask him, that it wasn't really an attack on the defense secretary, but as a request for clarification.
What do you make of CIA Director Porter Goss's resignation and President Bush's choice to replace him, General Michael Hayden?
It's very bizarre. You'll recall Goss telling the press, this is mysterious, and it's going to remain so. So I don't know. I mean, he clearly was doing a miserable job. I mean, it was a catastrophe from the word go. He was tired. He complained about the burden of work at the agency. He wasn't able, as he was in Congress, to go home on Thursday noon and come back on Tuesday noon. Took him back and forth to Florida. And he managed to incur the wrath of just about everybody in the agency and debilitate it even still more. So whether it was simply that finally Negroponte and the president were wise to the fact that he was destroying what's left of our intelligence capability, or perhaps he was involved in this Dusty Frago thing, the fellow who was close to the defense contractor that got Duke Cunningham in trouble. I don't think anybody did anything than applaud when he agreed to leave, and so that's for Goss. He's a good riddance in my view. Now, Hayden. Hayden is a uniformed officer in the United States Air Force. I was a uniformed officer in the U.S. Army. We, each of us, swore an oath to defend, protect the Constitution of the United States. Each of us had it drilled into us that it was against the ethic of commissioned officers to obey an illegal order. Here's Hayden, goes up to NSA, well-liked, respected, sort of a favorite up there, you know. Why? Well, because he drummed into each and every worker the 11th commandment at NSA, which is, thou shalt not monitor Americans. Now, the people at NSA were aghast when they heard of his role in this unauthorized, illegal monitoring program. How did that happen? Well, after 9/11, as the saying goes, you've heard it 100 times, after 9/11, everything changed. And Cheney went to Hayden, or called Hayden to his office and said, now we're going to take the gloves off on electronic intercepting. No one knew better than Hayden that this was against the law, pure and simple. But he didn't have the courage of his conviction to say, Mr. Vice President, with all due respect, I'm not obliged to obey an illegal order. I believe this is such, and so I can resign or you can give me a new job, but I'm not going to do this. Instead of that, and this is the insidious part here, Hayden, for whatever reason, decided to go back on his oath to defend the Constitution, on his ethos that he drummed into his workers at NSA, And he said, yes, sir, whatever, you know, if you, count me in. I can do this, sure, you know. Now, is that the kind of guy? Is that what we want running the CIA? I mean, when Negroponte and the president say he's exquisitely qualified to be the new head of the CIA, well, from their point of view, of course he is, because he'll do whatever they tell him, whether it's lawful or not. And with the record of the CIA in recent months, torture, kidnappings, keeping people in detention, incommunicado, and various other indignities, do we want somebody that's simply going to do what the president tells him, whether it's legal or not? Or are we going to do what we should do with General Hayden? And I had a very, very high-ranking general tell me when all this broke, he said, Ray, Hayden should be court-martialed. And I believe that's the case. He should be court-martialed rather than nominated to be head of the CIA.
That was 27-year veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who, until his retirement in 1990, led one of two CIA teams conducting the most secret daily intelligence briefings at the White House. Read McGovern's articles online at www.truthout.org. For what was probably the first time, an environmental coalition was a key organizing element in a mobilization that was primarily focused on opposition to the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. The April 29th anti-war march in New York City focused on demands that the U.S. end the war in Iraq and preventing a new military confrontation with Iran. But the march, which attracted some 350,000 protesters, also demanded that the government respond to the needs of survivors of Hurricane Katrina and address global warming. The Climate Crisis Coalition, one of nine groups that initiated the march, is a network of 70 environmental, peace, justice, and labor organizations that supports an end to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. At a press conference preceding the New York City march, Ibrahim Raimi, a member of the Climate Crisis Coalition Steering Committee, said, "We bring to this movement the understanding that ending the war against the environment must also be a central element in our broad work for peace and justice." The coalition raised the connections between wars for oil, the lack of homeland security where hurricane victims are concerned, and the changes wrought by global warming. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus caught up with Raimi after the march, where she spoke with him about the interconnection of these issues and the coalition's agenda for change.
We see the climate issue and the global warming issue as being an integral part of the effort to stop war, to stop resource wars, and to create sustainable economics and sustainable energy.
Does the Climate Crisis Coalition think that in order to move on with any of your long-term goals, you have to stop the war first? Or how do you see the next year unfolding, or 5 years?
Well, I see us as being part of a very broad, united front of civil society that is demanding peace, demanding justice, and fundamentally demanding a shift in the use of resources for creating sustainable economics and ultimately saving the Earth. We think that the consumption of oil is an integral part of global warming, which of course is one of the things and the central thing that we are concerned with. But we also recognize that there can be no real peace and no justice without a sustainable future for all of us. And that means that in every aspect of the peace movement, the anti-war movement, the movement for social justice, that we integrate into those movements a recognition of the climate crisis and a need for direct action to stop it.
It's in my long experience going to anti-war marches, this is the first one I've seen that had right up in one of the top demands about, you know, any kind of environmental issue, really.
My observation is exactly that, too, that this is the first of the seven or eight major mobilizations, I guess, from 2002, you know, before the 2003 U.S. invasion, until now, that the issue of climate crisis and the issue of stopping war were definitely on the same page. I have to also tell you that Katrina, the hurricane that devastated New Orleans last September, has been a wake-up call for many people, not in terms of just the irresponsible diversion of resources from the people of New Orleans, but also as we saw today, or actually this week, in a news release, that climatologists and people who study the climate situation are in agreement that major hurricanes and superstorms like Katrina are in fact due to climate shifts that are at the core of the crisis that we're looking at in a planetary way. So Katrina, resources for rebuilding New Orleans, stopping the war in Iraq, and stopping global warming are all part of a basket of issues that a united front has to demand change in and also press forward to a political conclusion, hopefully, in the midterm elections this year, and we would hope in 2008 as well.
Do you put a lot of energy into electoral politics and into this year's elections, congressional elections?
Well, what the CCC is planning to do is to develop a platform of environmental responsible actions and legislations that we're putting forward so that in congressional races all over the United States, candidates from all the parties recognize that there are citizens' demands for legislation that, for example, will divert resources from subsidizing oil and use it for research and development to make solar energy and geothermal and wind energy, for example, much more available at a lower cost to people. The ultimate survival of the species depends upon breaking from an oil-driven economy and breaking from a war system that's based on oil, and making those major transitions to a sustainable economy, a sustainable environment, and ultimately a sustainable planet for all of us.
And I noticed you didn't mention nuclear power.
Well, my position on nuclear power is that nuclear power is another big, big negative. Our focus right now is not so much on nuclear power, however, as it is on sustainable energy, but I would totally agree that nuclear power and the danger of the waste cycle, the danger of another Chernobyl kind of incident, is very much part of a broad basket of issues that we have to address. I think that the technology to create sustainable energy is here. It needs some refinement. For example, General Motors is claiming that they can come up with a production fuel cell car by the year 2010. That's only 4 years away. Other manufacturers like Honda, for example, have really taken the lead in creating fuel cell technology that would only pump water vapor into the air as opposed to carbon pollutants. So my sense is that what is required is a shift in the focus of research and development, on one hand, to put money into technologies that are non-polluting and renewable, and on the other hand, to take money away from the subsidies that the auto industry and big oil and big coal get.
That was Ibrahim Raimi of the Climate Crisis Coalition. Call the group at area code 413-243-5665 or visit their website at www.climatecrisiscoalition.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you now with this quote by Noam Chomsky. Every advance in history, from ending slavery and establishing democracy to ending formal colonialism, has had to conquer the notion at some point that it was impossible to do because it had never been done before. If you act like there is no possibility of change for the better, you guarantee that there will be no change for the better.